Hello again. This is Script Lock, and I am Max Folkman.
And I'm additional host Nick Folkman. Today, our guests are Tanya X. Short and Rob Otten. Tanya is a designer who has worked on such titles as Age of Conan, Dungeons of Fate, The Secret World, and is currently the creative director of Kit Fox Games, makers of Shattered Planet and the upcoming Moon Hunters. Rob is a former head of production, New Media and Interactive at 20th Century Fox, and was a writer for Gears of War Judgment, The Vanishing of Ethan Carter, Battlefield Hardline, Disney's Playmation, and Alpha Archive. Is all that correct, you guys?
Yep.
Your reports are accurate.
All right, great.
So you worked on Secret World. That looked really cool.
I'm
a Mac person, so I don't get to play all of the cool. I remember playing Age of Conan a little bit back when I had a PC in an office, but Secret World, I was like, oh, that looks really... And that Facebook game you guys had was really cool, too.
Yeah. Secret World was super fun to work on. It had a lot of different ideas that I was really excited about, and I really enjoyed. My primary role on Secret World was a level designer, rather than a writer necessarily. But I did get to write some lines of dialogue here and there.
Cool.
Just because both of you have worked on or been a part of ARGs, The Secret World had a couple of ARGs, right?
Yeah, so it had, it was mostly promotional ARGs that were like really real ARGs. And those were through an outsourcing company. So I didn't directly become influenced or involved in those puzzle designs. But the game itself also contained some content that was almost ARG-like because it required the player to go look things up. Usually not too much further than Wikipedia, but there were some, you know, little puzzles. You had to go find a translator or something like that. Because the whole idea of The Secret World is there's conspiracies. And so if you find something mysterious, it's kind of up to you. And you can go, you know, game fax it. But there were a few puzzles people didn't figure out for a few months. So that was satisfying.
You also worked, one of your earlier jobs was working on the campaign for I Love Bees.
Yeah, that was actually my very first job.
Where were you in LA? Were you with was that 42?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Pasadena?
I was a sub contractor. I didn't meet anybody else working on it except for one producer who really needed somebody to call 1,000 payphones and see which ones were working.
Nice, you did that. That's amazing.
That was me.
Oh wow. I know, I remember. That was a big deal. Like, that was just logistically such a big deal.
Yeah, well, because the phone companies wouldn't tell them which ones were operational because they didn't know.
Right, of course. No, they don't know.
No, they just install them and fire and forget. And then 5 years later, you know, people are like, I'll pay you thousands of dollars to know which ones of these work. And they're like, well, good luck.
Get out there. So that's where do you go to get, or where did one go, and back when this was a relevant question, to get the list of the payphones in a municipality?
You know, I don't know. I mean, maybe they got it from I was given the list of payphones to call.
Okay. But then how do you even know what they're working? Because if they just ring and nobody picks up, then it could be working. It might not.
I would just call them and hope someone would pick up. And if nobody picked up, if it just rang forever, then I would put it on a separate list to call again later. And until I got a certain number of payphones over a certain geographical area,
So you just needed guaranteed wins, right? Yeah, and nobody recognizes the cockamamie things that have to be done in the world of alternate reality. Fabricating reality is a pain in the neck.
Yeah, definitely. I can't even imagine the logistics of the people actually planning the puzzle. But you know, they could probably safely assume there would be, you know, some 30 payphones that I would find.
Well, you take it. There's somebody in a room who's like, I got it. We call payphones. And then it's like, oh, my God, hundreds of hours of work later.
That's okay. I was still in college at the time. I was just happy to be working tangentially on a video game. So I'm pretty sure it was minimum wage.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Did you study design stuff in school?
In master's, yeah. My undergraduate was English literature. But I have a master's in interactive media with a specialization in level design.
Where from?
The Guildhall at SMU.
Oh, cool. Cool, cool, cool.
What is getting a degree in level design like?
Well, so at the time, so this was like 2007 that I was enrolling in this program. And at that time, there weren't really a lot of programs like it. There might be a lot more now. But at the time, what I wanted was a really, really portfolio-oriented program. So it was really just a year and a half of ex, you know, video game industry folks yelling at me to make my levels better.
And, without a clear
theory, but you know,
without a clear metric on what better was.
No. They were very thorough about it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, there was a guy who worked on like Rainbow Six, and a guy who was a very established Doom modder, and it was very, I guess, results oriented.
That's good. No, that's I think useful, because I think I know a lot of people who have advanced degrees in gameology and gamography and gamographics, and it seems like it's dominated by a lot of theory. Not dominated, but there's a lot of theory mixed in with what I think you're right. In some ways, it's a very much a craft.
Yes. It was almost more of a craft school for sure. And their primary bragging statistic at that time, at least, was their hiring rate, which was higher than any other's.
Oh, that's cool. That's useful.
Yeah.
And your attitude's like, no, I just want to get a job on something that's portfolio focused. I can figure out all the lofty stuff on my own is a very grounded take.
They obviously, I feel like most theory stuff you can, it's a little bit easier to self-teach rather than figuring out the tools for the discipline that's required for really crafting something that's shippable, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm. easier with external eyes.
And just to wind the clock back a little bit before that, even, this is a question for both of you. When was the first time you realized that someone made video games?
You know, I don't remember exactly when. It must have been somewhere in my first year of college when I first looked through Craigslist for jobs and I saw there was an internship at a little games company. But it didn't really hit home until... So I started a website called gamergirl.org. And it was a silly little like game review website.
It wasn't a 503c, a nonprofit.
it was there were no numbers or letters. It was just a little website with 10 college girls writing reviews of video games. But I emailed out of the blue the Zoo Tycoon company, and I got a response from a single individual who agreed to do an interview with me. And that was kind of the first moment where I was like, oh, wow. Like, not only are these humans out there, but they are humans that I could interact with, I guess, which is a different emotional place than just knowing intellectually that they're there.
My answer was when I had an Atari 2600 at a very young age, there was a paperback book that like I got out of the library that was something like Secrets of Video Games. And it was, I'm pretty sure the adventure credit screen was in there. And this may be kind of like false memories, but, and I'm pretty sure that with the aid of this book, I was able to get to the adventure credit screen, which I don't know if you guys remember or know what this I'm talking about. In the 2600 game adventure, there's a sort of Easter egg, you know, it's not a bug, it's a feature type thing, where if you do this kind of arcane pattern of things, you see essentially like a single screen that has the guy who created the game's name on it. And he had kind of hidden, and this is a very early, this is a whole sorts of implications for everything in the game industry today, but he, you know, wasn't getting credit for the game from whoever he was making the game from. This is my understanding of the events. And so therefore he kind of coded in this sort of sneaky way that he could have a screen that he could like, you know, show his niece or nephew or something. They're like, look, I made this thing. And so there was a book that like gave you the directions. It was kind of almost like a magic book. It was like, here's the secret, the secrets behind the video games. And you go in and you do these things and you see the credit screen with the guy who made the game. And I was like, oh, there's a single person made all this. Like, that's crazy. it was still this kind of faceless, you know, I don't know what I even at like 7 would have imagined this person looked like. Probably not like me. Actually, probably maybe a little. Anyway, but yeah, and that to me was like a real, like, it was that these were the creators were the secrets. And in some ways, I feel like creators still are in many ways the secrets.
That was like a sort of a trend of just developers, like, kind of like an offshoot of developers putting photos of themselves inside their games and family photos like that, which they don't really do anymore.
Well, they get fired if they do it now.
Yeah.
If you get caught, I mean, like, that's, you know.
Not like that, but like putting people, in like, hey, this is the whole crew doing, or the Tony Hawk people just doing their Bales videos of them doing skateboarding through the office.
It's, I mean, you know, from a lame business perspective, I mean, this, you know, it is very much to the advantage of game publishers to have their creators be as anonymous as possible on a just a straight, like, I'm running a business level. And something that the movies, you know, somehow messed up, you know, because if studios had their ways in the 40s, it would have been like the director and writer and all these things would have been more understated. But it, I mean, yeah, you know, if I not for the existence of guilds,
maybe.
Yeah, totally. It's guilds. Absolutely. If not for the existence of guilds, it would just be, you know, 20th Century Fox presents the movie with actors. Made by no one, which is pretty much what games are. Or made by, like, a list of, you know, 1,800 people all in the same type at the end that nobody reads.
People remember the directors and the actors, though. No one talks about the writers for film still.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, that's I mean, a certain level of film nerd loves.
Sure.
Loves knowing, you know.
But they're invested.
You know, Gordon Willits or, you know, or you know, the cinematographers or the writers or the prop stylists or any of that stuff. But, yeah, it takes a certain sort of a trade craft to... Nerdcraft, I suppose, is a better way to put it.
Did you have a question or do you want me to go?
I was going to say, like, we're already jumping around a bunch of topics in, like, the first 10 minutes, so we should just get it done with ahead of time. How did both of you get into the industry?
Well, I thought that was what your first question was.
Yeah, it was, yeah. But keep going.
She answered an ad.
Yeah, well, okay, so my first paid job was this 42 Entertainment, I Love Bees, calling payphones nonsense.
Could you explain what I Love Bees is to people who don't know what it is?
Yes, so it was a mysterious website that appeared to be from a woman who kept bees as a hobby, but then she reported that her bees were acting strangely and that there were weird messages, and it became increasingly clear that they were from aliens, and now most gamers know about alternate reality games, but... it was pretty fresh in 2003.
And this was marketing for Halo 2.
Yes. Yeah. It was a hardly. Campaign that went for months in the lead up for the launch of Halo 2.
But the coolest thing about it is that you really would be hard-pressed to... I mean, not that I have any idea what the fuck is going on in any Halo game, by the way, but I would be really hard-pressed to make a connection between the event of this woman and her kooky bees with the Covenant or... the Halo franchise in general, which is part of what made it so cool, is that it didn't feel like it was spoon-feeding you marketing messages all the time. I mean, I think the early days of ARGs, which is something I can talk about for a long time and won't.
We will get to Alpha Archive.
Yeah, no, I'm not even that's a whole other, trust me. But I mean, the early days of ARGs are really fun because I think everybody was sort of like, oh, this is new. We'll just let these crazy kids do what they're going to do. And a little bit, now they've gotten a little bit more overtly connected to the product, which I think also has something to do with their general withering in the public eye.
Yeah, I think there's a general understanding that the average person, and I mean even the average gamer, won't engage with it once they understand how difficult it is.
Yeah,
it has to be that difficult in order. Like, it has to be both inaccessible. Like, it has to be inaccessible in order to succeed. In which case, you know, it's going to be inaccessible. So you're not going to get as wide a reach as maybe your marketing people claimed.
Yeah, no. Well, you get all the ancillary... Anyway, okay, I won't go into this. But you get all the, like, yeah, we made 5 million impressions. It's like, yeah, because you sent a cake to a journalist and he took a picture of it and posted it on a blog. Yeah. That doesn't really count. Like, those aren't impressions.
But what happened after I Love Bees for you, Tanya?
So I also... Actually, it was before that. I did have an unpaid internship. It was just a two-man company working out of a guy's living room. And I felt mildly uncomfortable the first time going to a strange man's house based on a Craigslist ad, by the way.
I've been there.
Well, it was a legit little company, and they were working on a bunch of pitches for work for hire, which I didn't know existed until that moment. They taught me what an asset list was and had me, you know, try to help them organize their materials. And now the guy who was running that little company, he's actually a consultant talking about the science of happiness. Crabtree is like a world touring happiness science guy.
Still working out of his living room.
I haven't been to his house now that he lives in New Zealand or wherever.
I was gonna say, like, his living room in space, but in New Zealand's close enough. Yeah.
And what about after that? No, that was before. So what happened after I Love Bees?
Skipping.
After I Love Bees, I finished college, and I was running GamerGirl.org, and I was really obsessed with this online text game.
What's that?
So it was called Ayatollia. It's a commercial MUD, multi-user dungeon, mm-hmm. as they called them. And I was obsessed with it to the point where I had an intervention from my boyfriend. And then I quit it for a few months, and we moved, and I was teaching English in Japan. And then they approached me, the runners of the MUD, to be a volunteer community organizer for them. So I did that for about a year, I think.
So they successfully sucked you back in?
Yes, yes, but in a more healthy way. And then that was when I realized I could either become a game designer and game writer by trying the quote-unquote traditional route, which is what the internet recommended, which is going to be a quality assurance person. There were a few openings. There's always a few openings for quality assurance somewhere. Or I could go get a degree and try that out, even though it was newfangled and unknown at the time. I decided to go for that one because it seemed, I mean, I like being a student, or I did at that time. I'm kind of done with it now. But I went and got a master's degree, got hired by Funcom in Norway, and went to go work there for 5 years. And then they transferred me to Montreal halfway through. The Secret World underperformed from their expectations, even though I thought it did a great job for the niche game that it was always going to be.
And it's still running, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yeah. No, Funcom does really well by its customers. Anarchy Online is still running.
Wow.
And that's 15 years old.
Yeah. Wow.
But after that, that's when you created Kitfox?
Yes. 2 years ago, started Kitfox Games with a few people I barely knew in Montreal, and we're still going.
What do you, like, with a team that small, how all-encompassing is your role as creative director?
It's pretty serious. I mean, we have more structure than most indie teams our size. I've looked around at the few other studios in town and around, and for a four-person team, we actually have a pretty serious process, but that's all in the name of efficiency. We desperately want to be extremely efficient, so that's why we have stand-up meetings and tasks and estimations and sprints and things.
Are you all four in the same room every day at the same time?
Yes.
That helps.
Yep.
That
we
helps.
We have core hours, 10 to 4 every day.
Well, Canada. Ooh,
that's nice.
It's nice and light over there.
Yeah.
I'm sure you work a lot more than just 10
to
4.
Well, you have to be there those hours.
Got it.
The other 2 hours are up to you.
I've got questions written down for Moon Hunters and to talk about procedural generation stuff. But
I want to hear from Rob. What's
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Rob, how'd you get started in the industry? Like, what's your background as a writer?
Okay. I also have an English degree and came out to California to do stuff from the East Coast. I ended up doing a lot of music videos and commercials, as did most literary greats in their day. And
A director?
Hmm? No, I was actually mostly an editor.
Okay.
I directed a little bit, but I mean, like, you know, like Bolex, kind of pretty scraping the bottom of the barrel type stuff. And then I ended up getting into, I started working with a lot of people who were sort of the first generation of guys using After Effects and Maya and similar 3D tools and creating, it was like all of a sudden three guys in their garage could make a music video and it looked amazing and it was beautiful and had all these cool effects. And the record industry went, oh, this is amazing. We should get more people to do this for $20,000 as long as we can. And so I feel like I worked on, you know, early work from a lot of directors who were basically taking, you know, what was a teeny little budget, but because they were producing all the art and animation themselves, they were able to kind of deliver something and sort of, you know, pay their ramen and rent during the month or two that it would take them to do it. So I worked with a ton of these guys who were just sort of like doing it all themselves and making this, you know, cool big bands and cool videos. And then, you know, they eventually got to a point where they were like, hey, we'd actually like to get paid for this, at which point, you know, the record industry was like, oh, well really? That's so... You didn't say that the first time. And so it was kind of an interesting process for me. So I ended up working with a lot of animation and then sort of transitioned over into working on animation for games. And so like interstitials and cinematics and the parts of the game you don't play. And that kind of got me back into games. I mean, I had played a lot as a kid and sort of stopped, at, I don't know, like around high school or more or less. And, you know, it wasn't as important for me to have a honking PC. And there was this other stuff to do. And in college, I only played one game in college, which was Metal Gear Solid, actually, which was amazing. But we had a PlayStation in the house I lived in with some friends. But they were playing mostly hockey, and who gives a about hockey anyway. I kind of got back into it, and I remember so working with a friend of mine, we sort of pitched on doing some animation for a game. And that night, I went and bought an Xbox, the first one, and had like a dinner party or something that evening, and people left around, I don't know, 12:30 or 1, and I was kind of not really tired yet. And I was like, oh, you know, I'll just try out this this newfangled X machine green thing, and I plugged it in, and I think I put in Splinter Cell, and I didn't sleep. I mean, I basically went to bed at like 9 the next day and was just like, oh my God, games have gotten so much better. I need to start working on the parts that people actually play. Whoa, right? And from there, spent a couple of years in New York with a friend of mine on kind of a, had like a kind of creative consultancy company that was doing mostly the animation stuff, but then also some early design stuff and tone stuff. Then went back to LA to work as a consultant for Fox for a couple of years and got more involved in the production side and sort of, you know, working with studios and publishers and then wanted to get back into writing. And so was able to do that working with another friend of mine, my friend Tom Bissell, with whom worked on a few projects that are still like secret or will never happen or something. And then we were able to kind of work together on some Gears of War stuff and then some stuff for EA. And an indie game called The Vanishing of Ethan Carter.
You want to follow that up?
Yeah. You didn't mention Alpha Archive. Before you get into what you did on it and stuff like that, just give a brief, like a pitch to what the audience who have no idea what this is, what Alpha Archive is.
Okay, well, so Alpha Archive is sort of a novel that's a game for the iPad that you can download for free. And you can essentially read the first chapter or two. At which point, you know, there's a one-time purchase that you can unlock the rest of the book. And the book is, well, I don't want to give too much away, but it starts as one thing. It's essentially a journal written by a young woman who supposedly was involved in a bombing in Dagestan in 2009. And so it starts by you kind of, you're reading her confession, and then you read what are some earlier documents from the same woman in which it's kind of revealed that she isn't who she made herself out to be. At all, she isn't, you know, part of the Chechen separatist movement. She isn't necessarily even Russian, though she speaks Russian. And she, you know, turns out had a very unusual upbringing. And so the rest of the book, and the book is organized by security levels. So every, you read a couple of excerpts and then there's a challenge or a puzzle or some kind of thing that's kind of given to you by somebody outside of the book's world. And so there's sort of like a chat system, a messaging system inside the app, and you use that. And there's actually chatbots you can interact with and talk to, and they can ask questions about the story. And there's a surprising, except to me who wrote it, amount of conversation and sort of not necessarily depth, but just the number of things you can ask and the details that you get are pretty fun. It's pretty cool.
I love chatbots.
They're amazing, and I want to talk to you more about procedural stuff because I think there's a lot of overlap there, but. Anyway, so you hang with the chatbot. The chatbot gives you tasks. You do a task. You then get access to the next security level until you finish the game. And it all stemmed from a thing that was on the web in 2009 that was built by a team of people, most notably my friend Patrick Marcassano, who put together this sort of like web sort of intervention in which we filmed a young woman who was a sort of like a swimsuit model by normal trade. She answered a casting call for an actress to appear in a cell for 30 hours. And so we shot this woman in a cell for like 3 days straight, 10 hours a day. And Rosie, her name is, and she is just, she could not have been a better sport. And apparently just loved the whole experience. And she became this sort of, there was a website where you could go to the website, you typed in an IP address, and if you typed in a secret code word, you would get what appeared to be a live feed of her in the cell. And if you touched your mouse or touched your keyboard, it would turn off and it would lock you away from the site for 12 hours. You couldn't go back for 12 hours. But if you like called your friend, you know, you could, they would see it. And then if you called somebody like in London, they would all, and it was all this, there was this whole thing that used the computer clocks to determine what time zone you were in, and it was all sunk to the same kind of video server. And so there were thousands and thousands of people concurrently watching Rosie just sitting in a white room doing her thing. And she did all kinds of things, and there were all these modules, and then they were automatically shuffled, and there was some kind of algorithmic thing to try to ensure that people who had watched it at the same time of the day wouldn't see the same thing, because we had like a month-long period where we were doing this thing, but we only had 30 hours, which was a lot of content, so we had to kind of shuffle it. And there were people who were like taping it for 8 hours straight and stuff like that. And people, it was, I think, the last time that I've seen. And so we had about 1 million uniques in a month, which in 2009 on the web was pretty good.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And about 7 million hits, you know, people coming back and all that stuff. And so I think it was the last time that I can think of, though it's probably not true, where there was like a relatively large number of people who were totally fooled, like really, really, really thought it was real. And then out of this came a whole bunch of other, like 4 years of like dealing with other things that people thought were real. Like one of our, we invented some characters who are now on Wikipedia. Like there are articles talking about how, you know, this person didn't actually exist in like scholarly journals of stuff that we fabricated. Like we made fake documentaries that were kind of cited in people's like theses and things like that. Like it was like, you know, I mean,
one character's on a terrorist watch list.
One character's on a terror. Yeah, there's a non-existent group of Chechen female terrorists that we made them up. They are on a terrorist watch list for real. We did not do that.
That's amazing.
And it was a little scary too, you know, because it's sort of, you know, it's, you know, getting weird interference on your cell phone. You're kind of wondering what's going on, you know, that kind of stuff. But anyway, so it was a lot of fun. Alpha Archive is the culmination of all of that internet stuff, and it sort of talks to, and it, so if you're playing the game, you can go Google the things that are part of the world, and it's all pretty consistent. I mean, there's, you know, in the last year or so, we've kind of, Patrick and I have kind of agreed to talk about it, but we spent 6 years, 5 years, never talking about it at all, ever. So it was fun.
I was looking up, because you did do one interview about this last year, and you said that initially this was intended to be a teaser.
Well, the web thing was a teaser for the game. So we had the idea to do the visual novel on a tablet-like device in like right around the time, even before when the iPad was rumored but not even announced. Yeah. It was like, oh, this is the venue for us to do this thing. And the problem was is that it took 4 years to get, you know, money, people, resources, creative, all the things that it takes to make it together. And by the time we released it, you know, I mean, I wish we had been able to release it in 2012. Yeah. I think it, you know, I mean, and it's not like, oh, it would have been the biggest hit in the world. It just, I think the audience was much more kind of open, I think, especially with the iPad, and I know, you know, people are doing what they can to change this, but especially with the iPad, I think it hasn't been like, there hasn't been this like wow experience on the iPad in a long time. Most things are mobile, and it's really hard to do a book that has a significant amount of illustration and stuff like that on a mobile device. It's just, even with the bigger screens, they're still too small. You've heard of it, but not actually played it, I assume.
Yeah. No, I haven't played it. I'm actually really terrible at difficult puzzles. I prefer easy puzzles.
Oh, these puzzles are... Oh, well, so the web thing was more argy, and the actual iPad game puzzles are super easy, and I'm actually making...
Oh, really?
Yeah, super duper easy. It's like, oh. Talk to it. It's like, well, there's... Yeah, it's all very, like, hand-holdy.
The Kotaku article made it sound like you have to go on WikiLeaks and...
Well, yeah, but it's like... But, like, somebody's telling you to go. It's like, dude, go to WikiLeaks and get this thing. Like, it's not, there's not a lot of, like, deduction involved.
Okay, maybe I'll check it out then.
I have a question for both of you that's related to this. Rob, you said that same interview that platformers make things boring as they are so siloed, and people complain when they have to put down their tablets and pick up their laptops, but that's actually a cooler experience.
Oh, wait, platforms... Platforms. Okay, I think you said platformers. I was like, oh, no. I said, I like platformers.
And so do you think that extends to games? Are we going to see more of them take place over multiple platforms a lot more in the future?
I want to hear Tanya's take on this because she's working in a procedural content system that could be applied, it seems like, easily to multiple platforms.
Honestly, I've only released one cross-platform game. Shattered Planet technically exists in different forms. You can download like a free-to-play almost demo version on Android and iOS, and then it also has a premium Steam version, which has a bunch of other features on it. But
they don't talk to each other?
No, not at all.
Okay.
The Steam version is just a better upgraded version. That's kind of
sure.
It. So I don't know. I know from a developer standpoint, I get really frustrated with the mobile limitations, both the limitations of the hardware, but also increasingly the main problem is the limitations of the people who are using this they act very differently and they have different expectations than people who sit down and play a console game or play a PC game. So I'm not an experienced mobile developer. I don't really know how cross-platform works that way. I just know that as a designer, I want people to sit down and play for an hour.
Okay. Well, I think for me, and maybe you can readdress if you want to, what I was kind of talking about was actually cross-platform narrative. More than, I mean, so, and so the idea being that, like, you know, if I see, if I go to the movie theater to see a movie, and then there's something in a TV show that acknowledges, Marvel's really good at this recently, we can use that as an example, like the way that the MCU works, you know, if you go see Avengers 2, there'll be mention of the things happening in, that happened in New York in, like, Daredevil or something like that. That also might tie in with the comic thing. It might tie into a mobile or a suite of mobile apps that are kind of, you know, that talk to each other, that share some kind of consistent backend. And, you know, I mean, I get frustrated with games that, like for example, I love the Telltale games. It drives me nuts that I'll, like, play episode one on my, on, like, a plane on my laptop, and then I'll be somewhere else, and I'll be like, oh, cool, I'm going to play Borderlands episode two, and then I'll download it on my phone, and I'm like, right, it doesn't know that I played the first one. And all, it doesn't know any of my decisions. And I'm like, ah, man. And then I just end up kind of being like, well, I don't want to replay episode one. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go into episode two without having, like, my story. And so I just kind of end up not playing it or waiting until I'm in the exact same situation where I'm, like, on that plane with the laptop and don't feel like paying for Wi-Fi or whatever, or for some reason have nothing to do. And I'm like, okay, cool, I will finally play episode two. But it's, like, 4 months later than it should be. But I think, yeah, what I was talking about is, you know, the idea that, I mean, people, with games, it's hard. With Alpha Archive, you know, there are parts of the thing where it's like, hey, you need to put down your iPad and you need to pick up your laptop and you need to go to this website and it won't work on mobile. And that's actually a limitation of the mobile platform because you can't have extensible browsing in mobile currently. And we probably could have, in retrospect, figured out a smarter way to do that. But, you know, there's other things going on in the back end that wouldn't really work on a mobile at the time. It probably would today, but when we built the game. So, I mean, I think for me, I think we're going to see hopefully people who are looking at kind of content delivery in a more intelligent way, such that, you know, if you do go to that movie and you do watch that TV show, then maybe the content in your game or your app will be a little bit different or will acknowledge the things that it knows that you already know. So you're not being spoken down to in, like, redundancy and being told things you already know all the time. And at the same time, you're having this experience that feels like it's more personalized to you, or that you can, by exploring this kind of content pool, bring more to the surface that you want to learn. You can actually dive deeper.
Yeah, I mean, so the designer in me, I'm always, always about opt-in exposition. Like, that's one of the great things about games is the player can kind of choose how much exposition they expose themselves to. Mm-hmm. They can explore down the story corridor and really ask this non-player character over and over more details about their childhood or whatever. And I think that there's kind of an analogy there with, you know, if you are really into a certain world, then you can see all the different aspects and geek out about how they overlap and things like that. But honestly, the whole idea of transmedia, whatever, kind of frustrates me because I am tired of IPs being used and reused. So I don't know. I mean, I know that it's a great place to be in when you have an IP and a world that's so strong and so attractive that you can kind of riff on it forever in different directions and people will love it. But I have a little bit of defiance disorder or I've been drinking the indie Kool-Aid too much, but I want more new IPs. I want more new worlds. And I feel like Hollywood especially is siphoning down or doing some sort of reductionist process to get rid of all of the unnecessary IPs and only drill down into the ones that are super profitable. And that frustrates me as a creator. I want to see more different weird things. And I'd be sad if in the end, like if Moon Hunters does really well, then obviously we'll have to make, we really should make more Moon Hunters games probably. But I'd be really sad if I felt like the only way forward for my company was to make only Moon Hunters games from then on, you know?
Sure. Oh, yeah. No, I 100% agree with that. I think there's a couple of things. I think the transmedia thing, as we know it, doesn't frequently work very well because it doesn't acknowledge platform like friction and redundancy in ways that it needs to. And so, therefore, it really doesn't work for most content, right? Because you're essentially producing twice as much content and assuming that only half of your audience is going to see each piece or a small percentage of your audience is going to see the additional stuff.
Yeah, I didn't keep track of Defiance.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed interesting. I assume you know about Defiance.
The sci-fi show that had a game, like an MMO was made to go...
Oh, the sci-fi thing, the Trion Worlds, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I... Th- I mean, I know of it, and I didn't get a chance to really see it in its finished form, and it seemed to, I'd heard about it for years.
And they just announced they're going to cancel, they're going to end the show, but they're going to keep the game going.
Oh, okay, good. Well, that's good.
Interesting.
Well, no, that's good, because, I mean, it's sort of, to my lights, it sort of came and went very quickly, like, yeah, after hearing about it for years and years and years and years. But I'm also bad at watching the Sci-Fi Channel. I mean, I think
all of us.
It's a skill I'm working on.
Once they change that name.
Yeah. Well, you know. Yeah. Oh, SYFY. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, no. But to Tanya's point, I think I do hear you on like more IPs and more rad stuff and more different things, and not getting kind of pigeonholed into kind of being the creator of X.
Like, I mean. I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you. I just think if your game, Alpha
Archive.
Archive, yeah. If that had been, I don't know, Silent Hill branded, like, I'm sure it would have gotten a lot more hits, but I would be much less intrigued by the world and what's happening with it, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's reasonable. I mean, to me, I like the content of that world, but I find the delivery mechanism actually, to me personally, to be the most interesting thing about it. And so to that point, like, I don't necessarily know that, you know, that the, like, again, I think it's colored by, like, kind of what we have today, that the transmedia stuff that we're being offered now is only really for these, like, big honkin' IPs and, like, forming these universes and all this stuff. I think there are ways to kind of distribute, you know, more. I think people just need better tools. I mean, like, you know, there are ways to tell stories across platforms that are small and inexpensive and that can be any kind of IP that kind of comes out of nowhere. I really think that's true. I just don't think that we have the tools to do it because you can't distribute your messages, you can't distribute your content in an organized, intelligent manner. If you could do that, then you can pretty much assure yourself that, like, there's going to be a much higher level of content delivery efficiency. Like, in other words, like, I'm on my mobile, and so I want to go to this IP world. Oh, cool, here's something I haven't seen before. You know, you can't guarantee that without sort of a systemic rethinking. And that's a little bit of, like, what we were trying to do.
I see.
With the game.
You can't see me. I've been nodding this whole time.
Oh, no, totally. No, I feel you. I feel back channeling happening. So, I mean, you know, I mean, trust me, I, like, all for drinking the indie Kool-Aid. I mean, I don't even really see it that way. Honestly, I just see it as, like, there are big stories and there are little stories, and there are hopefully new ways to tell both of them.
All right, Tanya, we're going to switch gears for a second here.
All right.
So Moon Hunters is what you're working on right now. And
yes,
it is a top-down action-adventure game, also co-op, where you're also building myths of your players is a big part of the game, correct?
Yes.
So,
wait, how does
also
that, how does that work? How does that work?
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to ask. First, can you explain just like the building your myth part of your game? Because it's very interesting.
Sure. So first, imagine like you're playing a JRPG. You can either play it alone or you can play it with up to three other friends. And you're running around this world and you're beating up monsters and it's kind of a normal game. But you run across these characters and this is a fantastical ancient Mesopotamian world. So everyone's a little bit
wow, nice.
Hmm?
You don't see many people go into ancient Mesopotamia.
No. So
very nice.
Yeah, you're running around this kind of randomized Mesopotamian kind of world. And they have, you know, their usual problems and situations. But rather than the usual kind of quest, like, they don't give you a task so much as you interact with them, you maybe help them with their problem, maybe you don't. But what you're really doing in all of these circumstances is gaining a reputation. So you kind of get a reputation for up to a combination of three personality traits. So I can't name them all off the top of my head, but they're things like foolish and wise or cunning or brave, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that reputation, when you're at the end of your journey, becomes your myth. So the deeds that you did, even if they seemed kind of trivial at the time, like that time you helped the little girl find her necklace in the stream, it turns out, you know, the river gods were really happy with how you took the time to do that, and you become known as a patient person because the little girl told everybody about how this one hero came by before they went on to fight the sun cult. And so, yeah, you become remembered as a constellation. And then anytime you look up into the night sky, in the future times you play through it with new characters, you can look up and see, oh, there's Tanya the Wise remembered as a stag because of that one time she found this rare plant or whatever.
So is it sort of a combination of like events and some sort of behind the scene dice rolling as to whether or not these actions are deemed important?
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's a few dozen possible little encounters that you can come across. And it's not even completely opaque. It kind of just tells you, oh, you got some bravery points. Oh, you got some seduction points. And then when you get enough points to really get a reputation for being one of those traits, it'll tell you, you're now brave. People think that you will rush headlong into battle.
That's cool.
And
that's
then
super
at
cool.
The end of your session, every player gets kind of evaluated. And of course, everybody always gets a different constellation because it'd be really boring if everybody got the same constellation. And it's kind of like a combination party game, personality test, RPG.
How long are the play sessions?
Just like 1 to 2 hours.
Okay. And, but you have to finish, you kind of have to finish, not necessarily in one sitting, but there's like a demarcated ending of each session.
Yeah, it's definitely like, so the lens of the game, the premise of the game is that you're being told the story of these ancient heroes. And so the more you play through it, the more new memories are unlocked and the world becomes more complex. So like the first time you play through, you unlock the mountain tribe. Like, oh, the storyteller remembers, oh yeah, there used to be these mountains too. And then the world has mountains in it the next time it generates. And then,
cool.
Oh yeah, there were also swamps, and the river people were pretty cool.
So that meta-narrative, is that linear as it unlocks, or is it responding to like what constellations you're putting up?
Yeah, no, it's somewhat in between. It's not completely linear. In theory, you could, if you knew what you were doing, try to unlock things out of order. Mm-hmm. But we've pretty much made it highly likely that everyone will unlock the major stuff in the same order, just so that it feels good.
Yeah, that's also testable and a bunch of other things. Yeah.
As long as when you play the game, your world is unique and the levels that you play are unique and the encounters you come across, you know, you don't see them every time, then that's good enough for us.
When does this come out? This sounds awesome.
Oh, thank you. Well, I've been saying January up until today. It's probably more like February or March, but we're still hoping for January.
And that'll be on Steam or on console,
yes,
as well?
January it will be Steam, and then we will begin the process of getting certification for PlayStation 4.
Cool.
So that'll be in the spring sometime.
And also Vita, I heard?
Yes, we have committed to Vita, for better or worse.
I like my Vita.
Everybody who owns a Vita says they are amazing.
I like Danganronpa.
Yep.
I bought a Vita to play Danganronpa. I've only played Danganronpa, but I still like my... Well, no, I have something else to play. This is good. This is good.
I mean, you probably will only be able to play it single player on your Vita, which is the main problem.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
It does sound like you're the clap. And so are you lobbied or matchmade or whatever with strangers or with people? Okay, it's people in the room. Oh, I don't have any...
You can only play with friends.
I don't have any friends, so it's fine.
Oh, okay. You're set.
So co-op is a pretty big part of the game, but it doesn't have to be. But
wait, is it split screen or is it like Gauntlet style?
It's like Gauntlet, basically.
Okay, got it.
Run around, fighting monsters. And then one of the small innovations that we have is actually from a little prototype that my partner and I made some years ago called Dungeons of Fate, where they ask you, to make one of these events. Like, for example, the little girl who's lost her necklace. Everybody who's playing can vote on what to do. And then even if you aren't in the majority, like everybody outvotes you and they choose to, I don't know, laugh at the little girl or whatever, you still get a reputation for the choice that you made. So it's kind of in between a group story and an individual story, I guess.
No, that's great. That's much more interesting to me than the sort of like binary morality system of, you know, many RPGs. I won't name certain developers in Canada and Texas who are pretty fond of this. Where it's sort of like, oh, you did the good guy thing. You get good guy points. If you want to be a good guy, you should do the good guy thing. And to say you know what the good guy thing is, we'll label it and make it colored for you so you know you're being good.
Yeah, I like it.
Be good.
I honestly, personally, I play games to be surprised.
So totally.
I intentionally make my little stories to be more surprising than satisfying, I guess.
No, I think that's what games are good at, and that's something that they can do that like other things. Well, I mean, you can be surprised by a story in a film or something like that, but I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I find the kind of like, we're going to make you choose between A and B consistently.
Yep.
And like ignoring whether or not you like the situation. Like, we're going to take away your actual decision making and just tell you what the right answer is because you choose once and then you're stuck with that forever. I hate that.
Well,
so,
I mean, what's weird is that like players at this point are trained to look for good versus bad as well because it's been the standard for so long now.
Yep.
Like, the first question that I've gotten from a few interviewers were, so am I allowed to be a bad guy? And I almost have to train them into, like, that's not a thing. Like, a bad guy isn't actually a character.
Yeah, like, there is no bad guy. There's you.
You could be a cunning person and lie to people. Is that what you mean? But you could also be a jerk and be honest with them and tell them what they don't want to hear. That's also kind of not nice. Like,
well, and the fun part is then you get to create these situations in which the morality is a little bit more gray. And I think the biggest problem that people have with that kind of stuff is what I always call the kind of like choose your own adventure problem, where you feel like you feel like you're going to make a wrong choice no matter which choice you make. And so what I used to do is like I used to stick my fingers in the book. So if I messed up, I could flip back to where my finger would be stuck. And then like – and that would be the page. And I would always end up having like four fingers stuck in the book because I'd be – you know, N levels deep into the decision tree and still not sure if I had made the right decision for,
it's
you
true.
Know.
Although, and it's hard. There's two factors that I think help Moon Hunters with that. One is the fact that when you play co-op, which I don't think all people will play co-op. I think probably a minority of people actually will play with their friends. But when you do play co-op, it adds such an element of silliness. Like, friends just naturally are silly people.
Yeah.
And I think it helps having someone else there to witness you being a little bit mischievous. Like, it's almost, it makes it a safe space to experiment a little bit more than when you're alone with your systems and your numbers and trying to sort out your consequences. But there's also another element, which is, and this is a secret, there's never a wrong answer. I like to write choices where they're either both the right answer, depending on what you want, or they're both the wrong answer sometimes. But that's actually less interesting because then people will just learn to avoid like interacting with that object.
Right.
So 90% of the time, it's more like, well, do you want, you know, 10 plus 10 to your strength or plus 10 to your intellect, but either way, it's pretty cool.
Right.
Yeah. No, that's a really smart way to, as you say, especially when you're trying to encourage replay and sort of increasing levels of complexity and all of the things that sound like that make the game great.
I want players to feel like they can go out on a limb and try something crazy and laugh at the little girl and see what happens.
And every play session, like all the levels are procedurally generated, right?
Right. Well, not all of them. There are hand-built, like, little villages and special locations. Like, just today, I was working on this volcano level, which is unique, and you can only find it in, like, one of 10 worlds or something, and you run up the mountainside, and there's lava flowing and whatever. That's hand-built, but 90% of the game is procedural.
Cool.
And the game is pretty short, so you don't have the same problem as other games like this, but how do you pace, like, a procedurally generated game? Or how do you deal with pacing?
Well, so that is actually a struggle. So for Shattered Planet was procedurally generated tile by tile, which meant that each room, you know, was made up of somewhere in between 6 and 30 tiles. And we had a very detailed algorithm that would have, like, the minimum room size, the maximum room size, the minimum number of rooms, the maximum number of rooms, the length of the corridors between them. And it was basically the reverse of a dungeon generator, which you can kind of randomly Google 10 different dungeon generators if you want to. The problem is that the way that we generated it, I couldn't do pacing. I couldn't specify that this, like, for example, building a little scene with a little altar and a little demon and you know, an interesting little encounter, I could only do standalone objects that could spawn on a tile. And we didn't really discover this limitation of our design, tech design, for some months into production. So we kind of shipped with, it ends up being very different every time. But the only sense of pacing in the entire thing is that there is a critical path, which is the level design term for the path between the start and the end that the player must go along. And that will have slightly different content than the side paths. And then the enemies, after a certain point, start getting a lot harder. After, I think, level 15, depth 15, they get really hard. But there's no other sense of, like, there's no boss fights, really, or dynamic adjustments. And so in Moon Hunters, from the very beginning, day one, we were like, this game is about having little hand-built scenes, and then the algorithm strings them together. Personally, I think of it as like a string of pearls analogy. And then that helps me as a level designer make more interesting content and be able to have better pacing because I can make harder little scenes and encounters.
How do you, like, are you just setting parameters for what, how it's going to distribute, like, story beats and stuff like that?
So it's a, yeah. So we have a pretty extensive little tag system. So, for example, if I make a tent where a priestess is singing, I can tag that with whatever tag I want. I can come up with tags on the fly. But right now, the two major tags are events and adventure. And adventure encounters are with enemies and fighting, and event encounters are calmer, more conversation-oriented encounters. And so by balancing the number of event-tagged chunks that spawn on the path versus how many adventure-type chunks spawn on the path and where on the path they spawn, I can give it a probability of spawning towards the end or towards the beginning. I can kind of shape the... I'm not sure what the term is, the pacing, I guess, of the level.
Yeah, no, totally.
The rhythms.
That makes sense.
Yeah. This is super interesting because I have no idea how tuning procedural playthroughs are like.
Are you using Unity?
Yes.
Okay.
Earlier we were talking about the good and evil choices that other video games do. And I was wondering, for either of you, are there any storytelling tropes in games that you wish we could move past?
All of them? I think I was saying, we were talking a little bit, I think, you know, just the core issue is that, you know, story is metered out in games in such a way that, and this is, we were having this conversation prior to the taping a little bit, but I'll recapitulate. You know, the problem is, I think, is that games are so exciting and interesting, and they take your attention away from the narrative because you're so caught up in what you're doing while you're playing the game. And so the solution that we have right now is that games need to feel like they're incredibly, or too often, need to feel like they're incredibly important in order to drill through, like, your attention span, which is, you know, largely thinking about other things, the things that you're actually doing. So it's sort of like, you know, you'll be doing something that's really compelling and it'll be like, you're doing this to save the world! You're doing this to save the world! And you're like, okay, cool, whatever. I'm just doing the thing I'm doing. I don't care if I'm trying to save... I mean, personally...
But there's some crates over here.
Yeah, you could tell me that I'm smashing crates to, like, you know, help an old lady or to, like, you know, save a Lithuanian tourism board, you know, representative or to, like, you know, save an entire planet. I wouldn't care. If I'm digging the crate smashing and, like, just kind of roaming around or looking for pickups or whatever it is, I personally don't care. And I think that, by and large, you know, we take, like... pleasure from thinking our actions are important, but they don't determine whether or not we actually, they don't make those actions important. You know what I mean? So I think there are plenty of games that sort of use big and bombastic story as interstitial points, you know, around and outside of gameplay. And I think, you know, by and large, they fall into tropes that are sort of, it just makes it really hard to do anything that's much more sophisticated than kind of like the average sort of comic book story, you know, in which you have to, you know, again, which you have like long arcs, but then that have to be entertaining on an issue by issue basis. So you need to make sure you're jamming all of this drama into these kind of compact spaces. Whereas if you were just telling a story, you would let it kind of sink in a little more slowly. So I guess my answer rather to your question is that, you know, I think we can maybe try to start looking at games that have stories that feel a little bit less important.
More personal.
Yeah, and that are more about characters rather than plot.
I mean, I think there are so many incredibly important games right now that are about personal experiences, but they're not being talked about as being important because they don't have giant budgets. I hope everyone on this podcast has been to itch.io.
Yes, yes.
Because there are so many great little games there about, like, people confronting their life experiences and really interesting little weird explorations of interaction. And it's sad because I was talking about this with a friend the other day, and they were pointing out that something like the Beginner's Guide,
yes,
which I don't know if you have played or not.
I have.
Yes. Is an event because, you know, X number of people bought it and therefore X number of people will talk about it, whereas a small game that, you know, it is a small game, but maybe not that much smaller than the Beginner's Guide. If, you know, only a couple of thousand people play it, it just won't have the same impact, and because they're not Davey Raiden or because they don't have a marketing budget or who knows what other reasons, but games that maybe should be seen as more important than they are already exist. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not those kinds of form explorations become more important in the years to come, I guess.
I sure hope so.
Personally, my pet peeve, I mean, I feel very, very terrible that there are cutscenes in Moon Hunters, because as a game designer, I have to say, I thought we would be through with cutscenes by now.
Well, talk about them. Are they bookends? Are they interstitials?
Yeah, they're bookends. There's the beginning of the game cutscene. That's not bad.
That's okay. You know, that's allowed.
And there's one little, like, when the moon goes missing, because it's a top-down game, we can't really do that without doing another cutscene. But it's, like, tiny. But it's still, it's like, this is 2015. I mean, Half-Life 2 came out in 2004. I thought, for sure, by now, gamers would not expect cutscenes to be in games. They would not see that as a mark of this is a real game, or this is how you tell stories, or this is a standard. I just the number of people who would be disappointed in Moon Hunters if it didn't have a cutscene is just absolutely astonishing.
Wait, the number of people
who would be disappointed.
Well, who cares? Does anybody actually care? In Half-Life 2, those things where you're locked in a room with the dudes talking at you for 2 minutes, those are cutscenes.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it, but those are still cutscenes.
I know, but I feel like if we accepted that as like a step past. Okay, so for example, Gone Home. Gone Home is a great game.
Yes.
No need for cutscenes.
No.
Very personal story.
But it's also like largely optional. I mean, Gone Home's a terrific game, but I mean, you don't have to. You can speedrun Gone Home in 5 minutes. You know what I mean? If you know,
yeah,
you know,
but that's great. I think that's how it should be. I mean, maybe this tells you more about me than about my design, but I personally want it all to be opt in. I want the player to want to interact with it. I want it to be an interaction.
Okay, no. So then you and I are agreed. I mean, like, I think you should be able to run out of the rooms when Alex is, you know, talking to you or whatever.
Yeah,
and there's no reason you have to sit there for that. There's zero. I mean, it's like everything's triggered, ready to go. Like, you go out of the room, the character who's speaking should say, okay, I guess we'll talk later.
Yep.
And boom, more robots, more shooting. Do what you want to do. You know, totally cool.
Completely.
And I love Gone Home because I loved exploring all that stuff. Like, I'm like, I have my own theory about what was going on with the mom and the dad, and I thought that there was an affair thing with the ranger or something, and then somebody was like, no, dude, the dad is the ranger. And I'm like,
what? It was an affair.
Okay, good. Thank you. All right.
Says, your friend was wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Ha-ha, friend, who's imaginary, as in keeping with my prior remarks. Sorry, you were saying.
I feel like in the 11 years since Half-Life 2, there would have been a big step forward in that, where the whole attitude towards cutscenes and the idea of me putting down the controller for 30 seconds would no longer be a thing that gamers would even tolerate. And then, you know, by now we would have people like you and me being like, no, I'm not going to tolerate being locked in a room. I'm not going to call you an amazing game because you locked me in a room. We're not even there. We're not even to the point where gamers care about cutscenes at all. Maybe they will.
I have a different formulation, and it comes from something I've been working on lately a little bit. So, kids, if you watch children with touchscreen devices, they are very, like, they teeter. So everybody talks about this lean forward, lean back problem, right? So I'm leaning back, I'm watching content passively. I'm actually doing it in the room just to illustrate so these guys know what I'm talking about. I'm leaning forward, I'm super involved in content and whatever, and in interactive stuff. And they're definitely you know, in a suspenseful, like, you know, Metal Gear type game thing, I get closer to my TV so I can make sure that I'm, like, not missing anything. Or, you know, I'm definitely get very lean forward. And then when, you know, Kojima's big cutscenes come in, I'm definitely like, oh, God, okay, cool. Am I going to be, you know, what am I going to be able to do stuff? And what I notice with little kids, they don't care as much. They tend, like, you can tell them a passive story and then ask them to do something. And if the message is communicated clearly, they're like, oh, cool, I do this thing. Now, the level of interaction, the level of complexity of the interaction that the kids are doing is much significantly less. But I also kind of think that this is maybe a way to kind of get more people into playing games or things that are game-like. Whereas I feel like, you know, my mom, who I could not put a controller in her hands, I could put something like a Disney like episode type thing where there's a little bit of cartoon, some simple little interaction, a little bit of cartoon. And I think my mom, though the content may not be, you know, exactly in line with her needs, would be okay with that kind of experience. And so when I look at things like, you know, I mean, I have a really tough relationship with games like Heavy Rain because I feel like that there's some interesting things happening and I see them connect with like a larger and kind of more like norm audience, like, you know, non-gamer audience.
Normcore.
It's not normcore, but it's it's something like just norms, like, you know, like non-gamers, you know, if we're weird, they're normal, I guess. If we're the zombies, they're
Muggles.
The humans.
I think
Muggles.
It's pretty weird to not play any games these days.
I think it is weird too, but I mean, but I think by and large, most people aren't like us, you know.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, the question is, I mean, so I get what you're saying about like the pacing and the kind of fluidity of people's expectations, mm-hmm. but I mean, Minecraft is a really, it is a bit of a black swan or whatever, but it is what it is. I think it shows that kids and adults can approach something that's highly interactive and choose for themselves how to, I don't know, take it easy or not.
No, but that's the thing is, right. Okay, so that's an interesting point. I mean, Minecraft is a completely open thing and you can kind of set your own pace more or less with the exceptions, if you're playing, you know, with the exception of the monsters, right?
Yeah.
You can more or less set your own pace, totally. But I mean, I think it's this, and maybe that's the evolution for these kids who go from wanting. But
well,
my
the kids are really into Minecraft story mode as well. So
yeah. Well, exactly, true. But I think I think kids, and you know, I do believe the children are the future. I think the kids
controversial.
I know it's a rough.
We're gonna edit that out.
Hello, again, listeners. We had some audio problems and lost some of our recording, but we're back now. We're going to try to transition back to what we were talking about earlier. So, Rob, so, as you were saying, children are the future.
No. So, I think I got what I was going to say. I tied the room together while we had the break. So, Tanya, you were talking before about having adventure tags versus event tags, and that mm-hmm. there's sort of like the using the sort of head versus using the fast fingers. And I think that for me is, you know, the whole interactivity thing may bleed out to something that's a little bit more, I don't know why I said bleed out, but it may end up in a place that's something a little bit more like that, where, you know, maybe what we consider to be games will be able to have a little bit less kind of digital, by which I mean like your fingers, digital prowess, and a little bit more, you know, using your noggin in between. And that may be that sort of solution to sort of that problem where, you know, you're not necessarily taking a break from being interactive, but you're just being interactive in a different mode, and one that is less kind of action-based. And I think if we could get to that kind of a place, I think we will start to see new and different kinds of stories emerge because we'll have a little bit more time to let people think and feel and choose, hopefully, you know, the way that they want to. Within a relatively broad series of options.
Well, I mean, I think that, like, The Vanishing of Ethan Carter is actually a really good example of a game that it does rely on some game knowledge, but it's really a place to be explored and to be explored in a puzzle-like manner. But I really enjoyed the balance between, like, traversing a space and exploring and having a puzzle to solve.
Yeah.
I felt like if there's any complaint that I'm going to make about Gone Home, besides the fact that I didn't like the actual ending of the game, but that's a whole separate issue, is that it did feel like every square inch, like there was no breathing room. You just constantly had more things to read and look at and understand and sift through if you're like me and you like opt-in stories. You really just had to self-impose your breaks as opposed to Ethan Carter, where you had beautiful, I don't know, visual moments in between the kind of cognitive load.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I can take credit for none of the design of Ethan Carter, so I'm happy to talk about it. I think the team, the astronauts, did a really nice thing there. I mean, to me, I think there's still kind of a middle ground between having the cluttered house and the open field. I mean, you know, the first time I was playing Ethan Carter, I was trying to find I remembered the astronaut puzzle. I remembered more or less where the astronaut pole was, but I could not find the damn thing, and so I resorted to using a walkthrough. And I was sitting in a chair in a kind of lab environment where I was working at the time, and somebody came in and said, like in a dark room by myself, and somebody came in, they're like, oh, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm finally playing Ethan Carter, which I didn't really get to play during the development all that much because I have a Mac. So it goes. And my friend said, what's the laptop for? And I'm like, oh, I'm trying to find the stupid pole for the astronaut puzzle. And he's like, wait, you're cheating at your own game? And I'm like, well, no, it's not my game in that way. And
well, to be fair, that was the last puzzle I found. The game basically showed me on the map where to go to find the last puzzle, and it was the astronaut puzzle.
Oh, okay, well, good. I mean, which I love. I mean, I think it's actually kind of a really pretty moment.
Yeah. I feel like that was the right order after I did it that way. I was like, wow, if I had found this in the middle of the game, I would have treated the rest of the game much less seriously.
yeah, because it's right, exactly. Because, I mean, the game, it's very serious. And it's much more mean, I think is the word. Like, it's much more kind of cruel than I expected it to be. And I didn't really realize how that was all going to come together until I actually was able to sit down. I mean, we saw a lot of videos and had a lot of conversations, but... But I think, you know, I think we're kind of stumbling towards this sort of middle ground where I think, you know, I think agency is really important. I think explorable is really important. And, you know, I think in a way what you're talking about with kind of decision making or character interaction or, you know, chatbots or whatever they are, you know, if there had been a ghost that occasionally popped in during Ethan Carter and been like, oh, Ethan Carter, or no, rather, oh, Paul, the detective, you know. you should really go check out by the train tracks, maybe make a left, and there's the astronaut thing. Woo!
Yeah, that's definitely what should have happened.
I would have dug that. I would have been all in for that, you know.
We should make a chatbot.
Chatbot writing is the most fun thing I've done in interactive writing ever.
It was actually, that was my very first C++ game that I made from scratch when I was in school.
Oh, wow. So you had to do it manually. I did one in BASIC. But that
oh my God, it was so many if-then statements. It was the best.
Yeah, no, it is a giant. So there's a system that we used in Alpha Archive that I love and have actually been lucky enough to meet the creators of the system. And it's this thing called ChatScript. And it is essentially the project is a big C++ project and how like the parser works and all this other stuff. But essentially what you have to do is learn what for me as a non C++ conversant person was a pretty easy to learn scripting language that's like way better than AMOL or any of these other things, and it enables you to just be making pretty cool bots who can do pretty convincing and interesting things super quickly.
I'm downloading ChatScript right now.
Yeah, it's the SourceForge. It's super super cool.
There was that writing group challenged with the International Game Developers Association this summer, and I paired up with one of my programmers from my team to just make a little chatbot kind of game, and I realized about 75% of the way through that two people designing the architecture of the chatbot was too many, because I couldn't communicate as the writer what exactly I meant when I said, you know, in this topic then he talks about this.
Yep.
Or something like that. Like, I had to be in charge of that architecture. But at that point, it was too late. So it ended up being kind of disappointing. But
I had to learn essentially the scripting language because I couldn't have an engineer do it. I mean, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, I kind of still want to revisit that idea. The idea was that you're, you know, dinking around in like ICQ. In fact, the game is called ICQ.
Oh, yeah, cool.
and somebody pokes you and they're like, hey, it's can't believe it's you. I haven't seen you in years. And you're like, who are you? I still love that idea that like they're trying to get data on you while you're trying to figure out who they are and why they think they know you.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah, it was going to be a fun. I need to revisit it because, like I said, it only got like maybe a third of the way towards what I wanted in terms of sophistication of the chatbot. But
I feel like Christine Love's game does a great job. Not Analog, but the one
Hate Story.
Is it just called Hate Story? The like BBS one.
BBS one.
It's Analog, a Hate Story, but she also had something else, a Love Story. There was a game before Analog.
I do not know. All I know is I really liked a Hate Story, but it wasn't BBS. It was just a
no. That was the Korean AI visual novel thing.
Yeah.
Which is terrific. Though that one, and I had this conversation with her a couple of years ago. I was like, oh man, you should have used a chatbot because it immediately is like this way. It's called Digital Love Story.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, I was like, oh, you should use a chatbot because it's actually not that. Because right in the very beginning of the game, it says like, oh, my language parsing input
is so
broken. And I was like, what? What? Really?
I was expecting it to come back.
I know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, argh. But I mean, the complexity of the web that she wove through that thing, I mean, she's allowed, it mitigates the, I mean,
it
having to write
it. A little bit crazy.
On top of that, to write a chatbot, as one who knows, take it from one who knows, telling a complex story with a chatbot thrown in.
Well, you know, it just occurred to me that, like, the most simple version of a chatbot, you could kind of see that her story is almost like the most minimal chatbot.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean,
it's just keywords, right?
No, I know exactly. I mean, it's just metadata. I mean, that.
Yeah.
I mean, I really, really like that. But I was like, man, this would have been so much easier to do.
Yeah. Well, hey, maybe that's a genre that deserves more exploration.
The meta tag fiction.
Yeah.
But there was a discussion about more Her Story like games. Like, would you be able to make that to a genre without it just being another version of Her Story?
Yeah, I think games based on information retrieval have their place. I think it's not going to... I don't think you can do something that's just as simple as... You ever look... I mean, like, there's a company in Northern California, upstate, called Palantir, and they are, like, a intelligence analysis company. And so they do things like they take, like, the Enron emails, and then they, like, visualize them and let lawyers go in and, like, make connections and find proofs and all this stuff. And, I mean, that is essentially a game. It's an investigation game. And they do a lot of stuff for the military and heat maps and... where things people are blowing things up in foreign countries and so what area is categorically dangerous versus not. And so there's this huge number of tools that they have that are all centered around information retrieval. And I'm like, yeah, this is totally a game. I mean, like, it's not a game because it's actually very, very life and death serious stuff, but it is those kinds of tools have extensibility to play. And, you know, and I think in talking about the kinds of stories that, like, are going to fit this sort of, you know, like, new paradigm that we're all kind of talking about. Like, investigation and clue hunting is a big part of that.
Yeah.
And so it feels like a pretty natural... And people like that. People like solving mysteries. And, you know, you're the hero of your story now, and you're solving the mystery. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of directions that kind of thing can be taken. Her Story is a very bold stride forward, but it's also, like, you know, it's one media stream and one interaction stream, basically.
Yeah.
So it's going to get a lot crazier.
Also,
and there were like FMV games in the 90s. There was a game called Spycraft that had a whole bunch of different kinds of tools and stuff like that. And there were all these kind of...
Well, I know Her Story was directly based on a particular game.
Oh, really?
Do very well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the content and the... it is a different game, but I mean the structure of it was directly based on a game from what I understood.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool. That's interesting. Was it like a game from like the 90s?
Yeah, that nobody played.
Yeah.
From the same creator?
I don't think so.
That's interesting.
No, because Sam...
I should have done my research before saying that, but I that's what I heard.
Yeah, no, I mean...
It'll be homework, an exercise for the listener.
Mr. Barlow's been around for a while, but I don't think he was making FMV games. Anyway.
But Tanya, you were just talking about how you did a group thing with you and your programmer where you were the head writer, but you were also part of a short fiction writers group, right?
That's true.
What do you write?
I write short fiction every month. I started the group 4 years ago now, with a few colleagues at Funcom who liked to write on the side, because I was frustrated several years running at not being able to do NaNoWriMo.
Yeah.
November is always my busiest month every year. Every year. It doesn't matter what year it is. November is always terrible. Well, wonderful, but terrible for doing NaNoWriMo. So I started this group so that I would have peer pressure to write at least a little bit on a regular basis. And I definitely think it's made me a better writer, for sure.
Has it helped with working at your company and working in games?
It's given me more confidence. I don't know if it's had any measurable change, other than I think I've gained some skill points in writing, and I have more confidence as a storyteller. I mean, having your fiction published in a magazine is kind of pointless in 2015, but it still feels good. So, yeah.
I have no transition for this question, but it's for both of you. Both of you have talked about systemic-based gameplay and procedural gameplay as well. Do you think that we're moving more towards that with video games, or that we should be moving towards that and away from less linear stories?
God, I hope so.
Yeah, me too. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as somebody who's written big linear video games, I think I would have to be crazy to kind of put all my eggs in that basket, whatever the expression is, just because it just seems like that's neither what people really want. You know, if you look at, like, the popular and critically acclaimed games, you're seeing a lot more trending towards procedural narrative and or emergent narrative. You're seeing a lot more kind of big worlds, a lot more sort of like just letting the player do whatever they want to do, not what you, the designer, tell them that is right at that moment in time. And so, if I wanted to make that kind of game, I would be much better served by wanting to be a filmmaker, but I don't want to be a filmmaker, which sets me apart from a lot of games people. Am I right? But no, and I don't. I mean,
you're
I like
the one in California.
Yeah, exactly. I like this stuff. If I wanted to be a filmmaker, I had my chance to kind of, you know, and I said, no, you know what? I want to do this other thing. So I feel like, you know, the kind of linear game thing is, you know, I mean, I love people who really love that kind of thing dearly, and it's not a judgment on them. It's just more sort of like, for me, I'm just sort of like, well, you know, that had its time, but I think we can do more. Like, I mean, our computers are better than that, than recapitulating television.
I think it depends what you mean by linearity. Like, I don't think that the amazing things that the, Walking Dead and, sorry, I just blanked on their name, Telltale, that's right. I don't think the Telltale type storytelling linear-ish game is going to go anywhere. I think, if anything, that might replace television or something like that. I just wouldn't be surprised if they start being called something different than games, because kids are growing up with Minecraft as their default. Like, that is their Mario. So they are going to expect more system-driven interactions and more worlds that do something when I poke at them. So I mean, maybe it'll become more insular, these worlds of the system-driven versus the linear. And maybe it'll be that I feel like the system-driven games are really scary to big teams. And so that's where part of the division is coming in, is that if you have 1,000 employees, you're, you know, a few different big Titanic studios, it's really terrifying to think that all of your systems interlock and one thing could break every other thing, and you can't predict your player's experience, you can't actually say what it's going to be. And, like, I know for a fact that most of the companies we've talked about tonight are looking into, even the giant ones, especially the giant ones, are looking into how to use procedural generation in some way. But I don't think they're looking to use it in any interesting way. They just are curious because they know that little teams like mine can produce 10 times more content more efficiently than they can when we use procedural generation. But I think ultimately you can't make a good procedural game with a giant team. So it'll always kind of be this indies on the forefront until the tech is established for a particular thing. And then maybe it'll go into the AAA, but it'll always be safer to be slightly more linear for when there's millions of dollars involved, I think.
Well, what do you think about, like, the sort of collective mass freakout over something like No Man's Sky?
I was just going to talk about No Man's Sky.
So, didn't mean to steal your question.
I hope No Man's Sky is amazing. That would be great.
There's going to be a lot of interested companies watching to see how successful they are with what they
Well, yeah, no, I'm not even, and whether or not it's actually It's interesting. Whether or not it's a great game experience or a great play experience is almost not the point. I think, you know, to me, what I mean, watching it on, like, Colbert and stuff like that, and, you know, hearing from everybody at E3 that, like, you know, that, like, Spielberg and Billy Wilder and Stanley Kubrick were, like, standing in line, you know, to get a behind-the-closed-doors demo during E3, that kind of thing. But that, to me, is it just makes it more... I mean, like, you know, procedural content generation is nothing new. Certainly, I mean, there's, you know, things like FTL. There's also things like Houdini, which is, you know, a 3D engine.
NetHack, Rogue.
Yeah, exactly. Truly. I mean, like, there's nothing new about this, but it seems like that the collective, you know, sort of media consciousness has acknowledged that it is okay for computers to tell us stories with lessened human intervention in a way. And I think that sets expectations in a funny way that will benefit this kind of coming online in a more meaningful way soon, where it's sort of like, oh, it's okay that I got a planet in No Man's Sky and there's nothing to do on it because it's a planet that no one's ever seen before. Oh my God. Like, and it's going to take some time, but we'll soon be able, I don't know that every, you know, and I don't think we should have the expectation that it's going to be a continuously great experience, but I think it like, once we're like, okay, it doesn't have to be great because it is sort of random, but it is mine and it is different and it is unique and sort of personal. Once we're able to make that a little bit better, I think then it gets really interesting really quickly. And it sounds like what you're doing is being a little bit more careful about the kinds of patterns that you're allowing. But, you know, but in doing so, I think you're allowing for a more curated and ultimately more pleasurable experience through the course of the game, especially with short play sessions and repeatability being a big part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a spectrum. But I feel like there will always be a like room for a certain kind of person, a certain, like, maybe in a certain mindset where you just want it to be awesome for an hour. You don't want to fiddle around with maybe an empty planet, and you don't want to see whether or not it's good this time. Like, you just want it to be good, and you want to sit on your couch and, like, I don't know, see what happens next. Like, I don't think that'll go anywhere, but I'm glad that there's more space now. I think 10 years ago, people looking at procedural generation, like, they were cowboys, whereas now it's very much a hot topic, and that's great. I think it's growth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely more space. No pun intended.
And that was intended.
I was totally intended. That was like I was waiting to say that.
Tanya, you touched on this briefly earlier, but this is for Rob too. How does procedural or systemic gameplay affect development?
My writing, like, to get a sense of how much I need to make, I there's always numbers involved. Like, I have to calculate, okay, what is the minimum number of interactions that will happen in this area? What are the maximum number of interactions? What's the average number of interactions? And how extensive are they? How long are they? And those numbers can determine a lot of different things about whether or not the game is even coherent. I mean, I end up thinking of my stories more like balloons that I'm setting free. Like, I create a self-contained little, I don't know, a balloon, and then I put it into the ecosystem, and maybe later I can look for it and see if I can add in some consequences and other characters that can reference that. But in general, most of them are standalone little interesting things that you find that make sense in the greater world, but I can't, no matter how intense my algorithm is, and no matter how deep I get into it, in the end, I can't make everything aware of everything else around it. So that means that my characters are very self-involved. My plots are kind of all over the place. And I do end up leaning quite a bit on, like, the personality system helps because the player kind of makes their own coherent string through it. Like, they are the common element and what they want to do and what they get out of it. So hopefully at the end of it, when it tells you your myth and all the things that you did, I call it constellation theory. When you present a player with a bunch of random data and they see a pattern that makes sense to them, and here's hoping that's what Moon Hunters does, I guess.
which sounds amazing, by the way. I mean, it sounds like it's so nicely thought through, and for the scope and kind of scale of game that it is. I'm really interested to see it. Hopefully there's a Mac version.
There will be.
Yay!
Yeah.
Okay,
I have a couple of weeks after the PC version.
I will wait.
That's fine.
Beat's getting a PC. Emily Short, who, you know, fans of interactive fiction will know, had
Big
a system.
Fan.
Yeah, she had a system that she was working on with Linen Labs for a couple of years that I think she now has out on her own that was called Praxis.
Yep.
Yeah. And Praxis is an interesting, I think, metaphor for a kind the ways stories can be told in a kind of procedural manner. So the way that Praxis basically works is that everybody has every character in the story has a character sheet, and there are things that then there's a I'm gonna glom like some my version of Praxis onto her version of Praxis.
Oh, I was thinking of Versu.
Well, Versu is Praxis is the operating system behind Versu.
Oh, okay.
Operating system. I don't know what they are. It's the software thing. And so essentially, if you essentially think of like, and this, I'm making my own version of it, but this is how I understood it, and I'm probably wrong. Every character is a character sheet, and so there's a value assigned to their traits and skills and things like that. So you might have a character who thinks that farting is hilarious, and you might have a character that thinks that farting is offensive. And then that character will have lines that they say when something hilarious happens and when something offensive happens. So then if you walk into the room and fart, the characters in the room, depending on whether or not they find that to be offensive or hilarious, will issue forth their prescripted dialogue for their reaction to that thing. And so it's a procedural narrative is happening because it's like, you know, you weren't told, you didn't have to, you just chose to go into the space X and affect the space in this way. And so the myriad ways that there are to affect that space lead to the myriad number of, you know, pretty believable reactions from these characters that are, and also can in turn affect their values. So if you fart twice, you know, once, like, the guy who thinks it's hilarious may not find it so funny anymore, and eventually he too will become disgusted and will give his disgusted response. And so I think systems like that, that work in these, you know, that view the characters as kind of a collection of traits that have, you know, scripted dialogue associated with them are super interesting in terms of, like, you know, in terms of that kind of storytelling. And this, again, can get back into chatbots because chatbots can learn and can, you know, have all these other fancy things that they do. So for me, like, I'm really interested, you know, I mean, I just want a little thing. I just want, like, if I pick up a health pack in a game and I'm, like, super dead, like, just, I would like my character to go, like, oh, thank goodness, you know. Or, and if I didn't need it and I just pick it up and I'm like, yeah, well, whatever. That'd be fine. Or if I'm playing with a friend and the friend super needs the health pack and sees me pick it up and I don't need it, that the friend character should be like, hey, asshole, you know, because, like, you just took the pelt that you don't need and I do because you're a jerk. And that's not really...
They approached that with Left 4 Dead 2.
Yeah, no. So one of the narrative guys gave an amazing talk at GDC like 2 years ago. It was like the last talk of GDC in like 2013, I think. And his name is something like Elon, but I forget exactly. I should know because it was one of the best talks I've seen in this kind of stuff. And yeah, and they did some things like that. And it was, I think, the first time that anybody's really gotten it together. And, you know, I talked to him about it the next GDC because I'd seen the talk and I just wrote him. I was like, can I talk to you? Because this is incredible. And he was like, yeah, it was actually surprisingly not that hard. I mean, it took a coder who was interested in narrative and a writer who was interested in doing more than, yeah, and then actual interactivity, yeah. And all they had to do was kind of sit around and be like, what are your problems? Oh, I could do this. Oh, okay, cool. And it was like done.
Yeah.
Which I just, it's not, you know, it's not a hard problem to solve. And writers, bless us, are, if you give us like clear, like, especially the more, like, it's really hard to write 25 words for reloading. It's really easy to write 5 for reloading under heavy fire, reloading after the end of a battle. You know, like, the more specific the use case, the easier it is to kind of create something out of nothing because you just have context. And the better it's going to sound and the better the actors are going to do and all of these things. It's just that right now the ability to kind of, you know, essentially do what you're doing, which is to tag events in the game in ways that reflect how the characters in the game reacted to them. And essentially, the ability to kind of hold the player's hand and sit there with the player and be like, hey, your actions are affecting the characters in the world in a way that you're getting meaningful feedback from. As long as that's clamped, you know, we're not going to get any better at doing this.
Yep, I agree.
That was excellent.
Bam!
We should probably wind down now, so
we could ask, what are each of you playing right now?
I'm actually still knee-deep in The Witcher 3.
We are too.
Yeah, I've been playing it since before E3, so that's June. It's now October. And, I mean, sometimes I don't play it for a week or two, but it's good stuff. I like being Geralt and seeing that world. It's fun.
I am playing... I just started Soma, finally, which I like, but, like, I almost can't... Like, the whole, like, it just plays... Like, I'll be... And you're in a horror game, and, like, you go, like, to get a glass of water, and when you come back into the room and you realize that it's just playing the same creepy music and, like, occasionally, like, making the same, like, clinkety-clunkety-clunk in the distance on a loop, and there's nothing actually scary happening, that it's just setting you up for the actually scary parts, and I'm just like, man, I feel like a sucker. Like, you know, like,
I shouldn't have gone to get that glass of water.
I know, it broke the magic for me, but I'm going to get back into it. I finished chapter 1 of Metal Gear Solid 5, at which point I then realized that chapter 2 is missions from chapter 1, but harder.
Not all of it.
There are unique missions for chapter
2. I know there's a few, but there's so, I mean, like...
Yeah,
the second one, the mission where you have to blow up that thing with... You show up with nothing and you have to blow up the comm center.
Yeah.
You don't have
Fuck
to do
that
it.
Mission.
You don't have to do it.
What do you mean you don't have to do it?
You can just do side ops. Missions.
What?
You can do side ops and then... That'll advance the story eventually.
Shut up.
Yeah.
The main missions, it doesn't matter. You can either do one of those hard missions or just do a side ops and it'll just open up a new main mission.
Oh, I did too many of the side ops. Are there new side ops too?
Did you do all the side ops?
I did a lot of them. I enjoyed this. Anyway,
yeah.
We can talk about this offline. Okay, so you guys are looking at me like, yes, I should finish the thing.
You should finish it. It's not that much longer.
I was like, I'm done, right? It's over. Like, I mean, like,
no, it's not.
Okay. And then I'm playing Playmation, which I didn't really talk about, was this. Thing that I worked on for like 2 years with Disney that is toys that tell stories and through audio. So it's the idea of screenless gaming, and you run. It's basically like a Wiimote on your wrist, and you run, and Jarvis from Iron Man talks to you through your wrist, and you're wearing an Iron Man glove, and you shoot other toys, and it's a whole like Internet of Things. And I had worked on it for a long time, and then kind of got started thinking about some other things right around the time that the first release finished, and so I never actually got a chance to play it. And, you know, obviously some improvements and changes were made between, like, a year ago and now, or almost a year ago and now. So I just got a kit, like, a couple nights ago and was really enjoying, I mean, something I worked on that I just hadn't seen in its finished form, but also how it changed and how the system evolved. And it's like a toy for 8-year-olds, but it's really fun.
Where can all listeners find you guys on the internet?
Well, first, I recommend going to Steam, typing in Moon Hunters, and putting it on your wish list immediately, because it already has a coming soon page. Please, please go check it out. And you can find me on Twitter at TanyaXShort or KitFoxGames. KitFoxGames, yeah.
I'm on Twitter. I don't use it very well. I like reading it. I like being followed. If people ask me specific questions, I'll answer them. And then, yeah, I mean, you know, everybody's welcome to play Alpha Archive. I recommend give me, like, 2 weeks. Well, probably by the time this comes out, it'll be fixed because it is a little busted on new OSs. So we're working on fixing that.
What's your Twitter handle?
It's just Rob Auten, one word. Robauten, listeners.
And I am Max Folkmax, and this podcast is ScriptLockCast on Twitter.
And I'm Twin Made Films on Twitter.
And thank you both for coming on the show with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.